Welcome. Kathleen Pearl here. Thanks for joining me. Today is the first day of Elul. Yesterday was the last day of the month of Av on the Jewish calendar. This is going to be a sort of a different broadcast for me, but I think it's relevant in light of the perspectives, and we need to see what's going on from a scriptural perspective. Lord, we thank you. Lead and guide, anoint my tongue, my heart, my perceptions to be the tongue of a ready writer. Lord, I pray that you anoint the ears and the eyes and the hearts of those that hear, and that they would receive and understand what your word says, what your counsel is, and that we would know the times and season. In Yeshua's name. So thank you for joining me. This day, being the first day of Elul, is the start of the 30 days prior to Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the civil new year on the Jewish calendar, which kicks off the 10 days of Av into Yom Kippur. From now until Yom Kippur, the shofar is blown every day. Yesterday, and of course on the date, is August 19th on the Gregorian calendar. Yesterday was the last day of Ramadan. Now, the previous broadcast that I did called Jacob's Trouble spoke about some of the events that were happening. And it's really a prelude to this audio cast. Since that time, which was a sounding on the Tisha B'Av and the Olympics and all those events, the close of the Bohemian Grove events that were happening. Then I'm going to take it from there through. Excuse me. So Ramadan began July 20th. Muslims fast every day, and at night, they, when the sun goes down, they eat a huge meal. Very challenging on the gastrointestinal system. And this is one of the five pillars of Islam, to keep the fast of Ramadan. Therefore, this last week was the closing out week of Ramadan. Now, I'm speaking from a spiritual perspective, okay? And this is where I'm going to take this and line this up with the Word of God. As a prelude to this, let me say that and I've been going to Muslims. I have many Muslim friends. I've been going to Muslim countries for over 20 years now. I've also had many Jewish friends. I've taken classes. Philosophy classes and so on with Jews and Muslims. Therefore, my qualifier here is people are people. I want to make that clear. And they make their own moral choices. Okay? But there is a system that operates in Islam that those who look for power get swept up into that system. And it is a spirit. And Allah is not the Judeo-Christian God. Let's make that very clear to the upfront, the outset of this. You've ever listened to any of my works, you will know that. I love people. I have a love of God. I love people. And my commission in life is to share those things and to build bridges. But I hate wickedness and evil of every kind. And therefore, I'm going to deal with the spirit that's behind Islam. It is not a religion of love and peace. I have studied the Quran, take many, many classes on Muslim, cross-cultural Muslim issues, women issues, etc. Let's start with a couple of scriptures just to set this in the context, to take the gem that we're going to talk about which are the current events really of the last week, as and the setting as spiritually of the what is going on over the nation. Psalm 11. In the Lord put I my trust. How say you to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? For lo, the wicked bend their bow. They make ready their arrow upon the string, that they may privily shoot at the upright in heart. If the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, his eyelids try the children of men. The Lord tries the righteous, but the wicked and him that loveth violence, his soul hates. Upon the wicked he shall rain snares, fire, and brimstone, and a horrible tempest. This shall be the portion of their cup. For the righteous Lord loves righteousness. His countenance does behold the upright. That would be Psalm 11. Like, let's make it clear. Righteous do right. They do the right thing. And the wicked do wickedly. And they're violent and evil. Psalm 82. God stands in the congregation of the mighty, and he judges among the gods. How long will you judge unjustly and accept the persons of the wicked? Selah. Defend the poor and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and needy. Deliver the poor and needy. Rid them out of the hand of the wicked. They know not, neither will they understand. They walk on in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are out of course. I said you were gods and all of your children of the Most High. But you shall die like men and fall like one of the princes. Arise, O God, judge the earth, for you shall inherit all nations. The nations of the earth are a drop in the bucket to the Lord. A drop, they're nothing. They're like dust. Because he is, there is only one God. And let's look at Isaiah 55. Hearken to me, you that follow after righteousness. You that seek the Lord, look to the rock which you are hewn, and to the hole of the pit which you have been digged. Look to Abraham your father and Sarah that bare you, for I called him alone and blessed him and increased him. For the Lord shall comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places, and he will make her wilderness like Eden, and her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness shall be found there, and thanksgiving and the voice of melody. Hearken unto me, my people, and give ear to me, O my nation. For a law shall proceed from me, and I will make my judgment to rest for a light of the people. My righteousness is near, my salvation is gone forth, and my arm shall judge the people. The isles shall wait upon me, and on my arm shall they trust. Lift up your eyes to the heavens, and look upon the earth beneath. For the heavens shall vanish away like smoke, and the earth shall wax old like a garment, and they that dwell therein shall die in like manner. But my salvation shall be forever, and my righteousness shall not be abolished. Hearken unto me, you that know righteousness. The people in whose heart is my law, fear you not the reproach of men, neither be you afraid of their revilings. For the moth shall eat them up like a garment, and the worm shall eat them like wool. But my righteousness shall be forever, and my salvation from generation to generation. Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in the ancient days, in the generation of old. Art thou not it that hath cut Rahab and wounded the dragon? Are you not that which has dried the sea and the waters of the great deep, that has made the depths of the sea a way for the ransom to pass over? Therefore the redeemed of the Lord shall return and come with singing unto Zion, and everlasting joy shall be upon their head, and they shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and mourning shall flee away. I am he that comforts you. Who art thou that you should be afraid of men that shall die, and of the son of man, which shall be made as grass? Like, and forget the Lord your maker, have you, whose has stretched forth the heavens and laid the foundations of the earth, and has feared continually every day because of the fury of the oppressor, as if it were ready to destroy. Where is the fury of the oppressor? The captive exile hastens that he may be loosed, and he should not die in the pit, nor that his bread should fall. But I am the Lord thy God that divides the seas, whose waves roar. The Lord of hosts is his name, and I have put my words in your mouth, and I have covered thee in the shadow of my hands, that I may plant the heavens and lay the foundations of the earth, and say to Zion, you are my people. Wake, awake, stand up, O Jerusalem, which has drunk the cup at the hand of the Lord, the cup of his fury. You have drunken the dregs of the cup of trembling and wrung them out. There is none to guide her among all the sons whom she has brought forth. Neither is there any that has taken by the hand of all the sons that she has brought forth. These two things are come upon thee. We who shall be sorry for you? Desolation and destruction and famine and the sword. By whom shall I comfort you? Your sons have fainted. The life they light the head of all thy streets is a wild bull in a net. They are full of the fury of the Lord. The rebuke of your God. Therefore now hear this, you afflicted and drunken, but not with wine. Thus says the Lord God, and the God that pleads the cause of his people. Behold, I've taken out of thy hand the cup of trembling, even the dregs of the cup of my fear. You shall no more drink it again. And I will put it in the hand of those that afflict you, which have said to your soul, bow down that we may go over. And you have laid your body on the ground and as the street, and to them that went over. Okay, so this talks about the Jews, those in Zion. And I believe this is a talking about the great Holocaust, which many are denying that there was no Holocaust. Believe me, if you listen to the show, if you go to the Shoah Foundation, Spielberg has documented thousands of men and women who were children in the Holocaust. Shoah means a disaster, a fire burning. Holocaust means, you know, a burnt offering. That's who these people were. He has the DVD called Broken Silence, which documents the and there's another book with all the pictures called it's called Forget Not. I believe that's Lest We Forget. That's it. Jerusalem, you know, let me cut off my right hand, the cutting of my right hand. All right, we're going to deal with the spiritual issue behind the dynamics of what are going on. Let me say that in Isaiah 54, it says, behold, verse 16, I've created a smith that blows the coals in the fire and brings forth an instrument for his work, and I have created the waster to destroy. No weapon that is formed against you shall prosper. Now, that's the scriptures that I've been given this week as I've been dealing with these issues, and it has been brought to my attention what is going on. For the final week of Ramadan, which conclusion was yesterday, I'm going to give you a little history lesson in the process of this. This is sort of a teaching / insight, the application of current events according to the prophecies in the Word of God. Now, the last Friday of Ramadan, which was the 17th, is called Al-Quds Day. Al-Quds is the name, the Arabic name of Jerusalem. Now let me just say to you that during World War II, Al-Husseini was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and he was a personal friend of the Nazis and Hitler. There are pictures of him. He was one of the most brutal anti-Semitic muftis ever. I mean, he was, and he was the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. Okay, we are in, these are facts, and this is a reality check. Okay, so Friday was Al-Quds Day. What is Al-Quds Day? Al-Quds Day is related to anti-Zionism. It officially began in Iran as International Kids Day. It's began in 1979. It's commemorated on the last Friday of Ramadan, expressing solidarity with Palestinian people and opposing Zionism as well as Israel's control of Jerusalem. Okay. That's with it's commemorated in several countries in the Arab and Muslim world with protests against the quote Israeli occupation of East Jerusalem. In the Iranian military, there is a general, there's a division called the Quds Division, which is to say Jerusalem. All right, let's look at the issue of Jerusalem is importance. And this is the very, there are many books written about Jerusalem. One is written by a Crown Prince Hassan Talal of Jordan on Jerusalem, brilliant man, showing their perspective of the importance of Jerusalem. This is just a superficial one. The only city. It's Jerusalem is the only city where Jews, Christians, and Muslims consider a spiritually and historically significant. So, of course, the Muslims have some of the ancient patriarchs are part of their religious tradition. And Jerusalem was, but the, allegedly, the Mosque of Al-Aqsa Jerusalem was the site of the night journey and ascension of Muhammad into heaven. So there was a translation experience on his white horse from the mosque, Al-Aqsa Mosque, from Jerusalem to Mecca. So this is the link between Mecca and Jerusalem. This is a oral tradition. This is not in. This is not in the Quran. Okay. And so this is just a legend, a Muslim legend, and I'm not going to deal with the issue of the Quran or the text, but nevertheless, yesterday was Al-Quds Day, or Friday, excuse me, August 17th was Al-Quds Day in Jerusalem, and there were some violent clashes at the Temple Mount and restrictions for worshiping at the Western Wall on this latter Friday. A lot of this, or some of this, is perpetrated through the back doors by the Hamas, being fueled by the Hezbollah and by the Muslim Brotherhood. I recently saw a videotape where the leader, the Ministry of Interior for the Gaza Strip, was ranting over the local broadcast station that Egypt needed to help Gaza with their gas bills and their energy issues because they were the tip of the spear into Israel. It was very open and blatant about their intentions. And now even more so, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Grand Mufti al-Husseini of Jerusalem from World War II, whose disciple was Yasser Arafat. Let's make a real clear distinction here in these kinds of expository insights that the righteous do right and the wicked do wickedly. We're distinguishing between those who have done wickedly and a wicked system, have used a system of faith to fuel wickedness. Well, let's have a little look at what's happening in Egypt with Morsi, accordingly to WorldNet Daily, and an excellent interview with Joseph Farah on Peering into Darkness, PID Radio, on a kind of journalism. You're not going to hear this a whole lot on the regular media. But the Arab Spring takeover of Egypt by the Muslim Brotherhood is out of control now. And I'm just paraphrasing. Radical Muslims are beginning to crucify opponents of the newly installed President Mohamed Morsi. During a recent rampage, the Muslim operatives crucified those opposing Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi naked on trees in front of the presidential palace while abusing others. Well, this is very crude. This has throwbacks to the Turks, the Muslim Turks, crucifying Christians in Armenia. And if you go into the old city in the Armenian quarter, it's a quarter of the old city. There's the Armenian Jewish, Christian, and Muslim quarters of the old walled city. And the Armenians had a tremendous influence in Jerusalem for centuries. And so they have a whole quarter, it's not really, but anyway, they have a whole section. And on the walls, you will see often papers saying, "Remember the Armenian genocide by the Turks over the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, in which the Muslim Turks crucified and ripped open pregnant women, and men and women were crucified horribly." This gentleman was quoted in this article, that this Raymond Ibrahim, a fellow with the Middle East Forum and Investigative Project on Terrorism, said the crucifixions are the product of the Middle Eastern media, of those who the Middle Eastern media call partisans. Arabic medium called them supporters, followers, and partisans of the Muslim Brotherhood. Ibrahim said that the victims can be anyone, including Egyptian Christians. It's anyone who is resisting the new government, Ibrahim said. In this particular case, the people attacked and crucified were secular protests upset because of Morsi's hostile campaign against the media, especially Tawfiq Akasha, who was constantly exposing him on his station until Morsi shut him down. Ibrahim said extra brutality is reserved for Christians, but the crucifixions are because of Islamic doctrine and are required by the Quran. The time and other details about the crucifixions are not readily available. The Center for Security Policy senior fellow Claire Lopez cited chapter and verse from the Quran to explain that crucifixions are not simply normal for Islam, they're demanded. Crucifixion is a had punishment stipulated in the Quran, Surah 533, and therefore an obligatory part of Sharia, Lopez said. It's been a traditional punishment within Islam since the beginning. Even though it's not exclusively Islamic, the Romans used it all too. So, the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood haven't the option to not include crucifixion within their legal code. It's obligatory to comply with Sharia. And yes, it's for shock value also, to be sure, Lopez said. Lopez included a warning for Egyptian Christians and compares the coming treatment of the Christians to the Jews in Germany. The cops must get out of Egypt as soon as possible for many millions who will not be able to get out. I expect things will continue to deteriorate just as they did for Germany's and Europe's Jews from the 1930s onward. Lopez said the warnings were there long before the ghettos and the roundups and one-way train trips to the concentration camps began in the 1940s, she said. If you think this is just an Egyptian problem, you're wrong, dead wrong. Read Muslim Mafia Inside the Secret Underworld is conspiring to Islamize America. Author Pamela Geller of Atlas Shrugs, an analyst of the Middle East and Islam, fully agrees and also cites the Quran. Christians are in serious trouble because the Quran in Surah 929 commands Muslims to wage war against them and subjugate them. And they are also identified with the hated West in the U.S., Geller said. Geller also turns to Surah 533, Islamic hardliners. Quote, these are Islamic hardliners who do everything by the Quran. The Quran says, indeed, the penalty for those who wage war against Allah and His Messenger and strive upon the earth to cause corruption is none but that they be killed or crucified, or that their hands and feet be cut off from opposite sides, or that they be exiled from the land, Geller says. International Christians Concerns Middle East analyst Adrian Clay believes there is a relationship between the recent attacks on the regime's enemies, a recent Sinai military skirmish, and Morsi's moves against the ranking generals. The Sinai skirmish involved suspected Hamas guerrillas trying to cross into Gaza from Egypt. The Israeli Defense Force and intelligence learned of the attempted crossing in advance and stopped the incursion. 16 Egyptian border guards were killed in the attempted Rafah border crossing incident. Quote, it's hard to believe that President Morsi could have dismissed Field Marshal Mohammed Tantawi without the help of lower-ranking military officers. The military sense of prestige, which millions of Egyptians still take great pride in, took a battering following the militant attack in Sinai that killed 16 soldiers, Clay said. The military should have been prepared for the attack. Israel was. And the blame has largely been placed on Tantawi for his negligence and for embarrassing the military establishment, he said. Lopez agrees that Israel's preparedness is a slap against the Egyptian army. So. That border skirmish that resulted in deaths of Egyptian border guards was known ahead of time by Israeli intelligence, which warned their Egyptian military counterparts, Lopez said. She notes that Israeli intelligence avoided contact with the Muslim Brotherhood in the incidents because the attacks were a Hamas plot. Lopez added that even after notification, the Egyptian army didn't act. The Egyptian military did nothing, even as Israeli expected. Thus, the attack was carried out. Israel was totally prepared and responded, and the result was Egyptian military deaths. Lopez says, responding to, quote, crisis, she added that Morsi wasted no time in responding to the crisis. Morsi jumped on the incident as a perfect reason to purge the top ranks of the Egyptian military, install his own Muslim Brotherhood sympathizers in positions across the top, chief of staff and intel chief. She said some call it an internal coup d'etat, and I agree. It put Morsi in sole control of the legislative branch. There's no parliament right now, and in control of the political power in Egypt. The new defense minister is a Muslim Brotherhood sympathizer. Things are moving very fast, Clay said. There are mixed feelings among the military top brass in Egypt. He said some still support Tantawi, some have called for change. While many senior military officers maintain their support for Tantawi, his reputation took a dive among many younger officers who saw the need for a replacement. It wasn't just the attack in Sinai that led to this, but the military's reputation has been on decline since a few months following the country's uprising earlier last year, Clay said. For some time, the Sinai attack was the final straw, and Morsi may have viewed it as an opportune time to remove Tantawi and other high-ranking officers from key positions. Clay said, he noted that Morsi, not the military, took the lead in responding to the Sinai attacks. In doing so, while forcing the Tantawi out of his cabinet, Morsi has set a precedent that it is he who decides who runs the army. Okay, while the generals still advise Morsi, he can decide whether or not to listen to them. It's apparent that Morsi is quickly becoming Egypt's sole leader, which means control of the country will be in the hands of the Muslim Brotherhood, he said. However, Geller believes Morsi has a second motive for his action, a reign of terror. I suspect that Morsi's action was timed in part to forestall any further military action against the jihadis, Geller said, adding that the results will make Egypt's government more monolithic than it already was. Morsi is instituting a reign of terror to consolidate his power, Geller said. American Enterprise Institute Middle East analyst Michael Rubin agreed. Morsi is after power. Morsi certainly wants absolute control. The Egyptian army never has been saints, but Morsi will broker no checks to his power. The Muslim Brotherhood writes a constitution and imposes its dream of an Islamic state on Egypt. Rubin said Lopez says that this all means that Morsi is shedding his moderate veneer. The point I would make is that Morsi is not bothering to play moderate anymore. He's moving away very aggressively to consolidate power for the Muslim Brotherhood. Lopez says. She added that Morsi is now free to act without any concern for public opinion. He doesn't seem to care who thinks it what anymore. He knows he's got the USG and president in his corner no matter what he does. He doesn't have to pretend. No need for plausible deniability. He also knows he's got the majority of the Egyptian people behind him, Lopez said. Rubin believes, however, that Morsi will still try to play the moderate to continue to gain U.S. support. Playing the moderate? Morsi is going to play the moderate and the mediator for the world media, all the while complaining that he can't take more forceful action against the extremists because the radical fringe won't allow him to do more, Rubin says. It's nonsense, of course, but still an explanation that will satisfy American diplomats safe behind the walls of their compound, Rubin said. Lopez added to Rubin's explanation, but points to the White House as the main cheerleader for Morsi and the Brotherhood. This is exactly what many of us expected him to do, consolidate power. And I think the White House knew too, and not only expected, but wanted Morsi and the Brotherhood to take over Egypt, Lopez said. As far as I know, the White House invitation for Morsi in September still stands. Nor have I heard the slightest hint of criticism from any top U.S. government leadership figure about Morsi's coup. He knows he's on solid ground with this administration, Lopez says. Okay, that's the end of the article. WorldNet Daily. It was released on Friday, Al-Quds Day, August 17th. Let me just comment right here about this. That, of course, Barry Satoru, also known alias Barack Obama, has invited and rolling out the red carpet for Morsi to meet with him soon. Something I want to now turn over to and just focus and target this is a meeting that happened in Mecca on August 14th and 15th this last week. It was, and I just happened to stumble on this. I have not found any of this really in mainstream media. It's called, as I was looking into just some of the dates for the exact date for the close of Ramadan, it says the fourth extraordinary session of the Islamic Summit Conference. And this was put together by the Saudi King Abdullah. And the intention was, he's pushing to mobilize support for the Syrian rebellion. Now, this is the Syria to the north of Israel and Egypt to the south. And this was very interesting. It was held in Mecca on August 14th and 15th. And Morsi of Egypt was there. President Morsi of Egypt was there in attendance. and it was organized in response to the Syrian civil war. Nearly all member states of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation took part in this summit, although Syria was not invited to participate. Among the participants were the host leader, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, Turkish President Abdullah Gül, Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, Jordan's King Abdullah, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Qatari Emir Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani, Yemeni President Abdel Rabo Mansour Hadi, Palestinians Mahmoud Abbas, Malaysia's Najib Razak, Sudan's Amr al-Bashir, Afghanistan's Hamid Karzai, Tunisian President Moncef Marzouki, Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari, and Bangladesh's Mohammed Zilur Rahman. The discussion centered on Syria, and how to prevent the unrest be experienced in the rest of the region. I think my comment here is that King Abdullah is believing that perhaps his regime will be the next to be destabilized. So King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia also proposed an establishment of a dialogue center to address the sectarian unrest in the region, and this would be established in Riyadh. It was closed on August 6th with a call for more unity among Muslim countries and the need to avoid divisive tendencies. Syria was suspended from the Organization of Islamic States currently. It's symbolic. And this dialogue center, this counseling center hosted by the Saudis. And this is interesting because this was closed on 16th of August and the 17th was Al-Quds Day. The closing statements focused on the question of Palestine and stated it as the central cause of the Islamic Ummah. This is critical in our understanding of what is going on in this part of the world. Now, that was just a brief overview taken from, that's a paraphrasing from a Wikipedia source, which I do not like. They're very prejudicial. So I just pulled out the statements and paraphrased. But I would like to look at another article from the Roving Eye, which is from the Asian Times by Pepe Escobar. And I'll give you a summary of his article calling All War Roads Lead to Mecca, which I agree with Pepe. This is a spiritual issue. And very spiritual. This is not in the realm of reason and rationale. It's very spiritual. So we have to look at it from the conflict. We're ramping up to the conflict of the ages and the sons of light and the sons of darkness. And yes, Dorothy, there is a black and a white, and there is a right and a wrong. And there's a place of gray overlap called compromise. And you should never compromise your soul because you have to live with it. All right. Pepe Escobar. All war roads lead to Mecca. Pepe. This was undoubtedly big. Everyone and his neighbor were there. The Emir of Qatar, President Morsi from Egypt, President Gül from Turkey, Palestinian authorities Mahmoud Abbas, Hamid Karzai, the Afghan Prime Minister Zardari from Pakistan, Marzouki, the new Tunisian leader, King Abdullah from Jordan, key person, King Abdullah from Jordan, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad himself, all 57 member states of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, representing, this is important, no fewer than 1.5 billion Muslims worldwide. Arab News couldn't resist waxing poetically. What about in Mecca last night? The Holy Kaaba and the Grand Mosque was bathed in bright lights. The giant clock tower glowed in green lights on a clear moonless night. As the muezzin's heartwarming voice reverberated in the mountainous city of Isha, the world's leader sitting in Al-Safa Palace next to the Grand Mosque, repeating Allah Akbar after him. Allah Akbar indeed, and then straight to the business in which these leaders excel, squabbling among themselves and suspending Syria from the OTIC. So much for the idea, sponsored by the, quote, Islamic world's respected leader, custodian of the two holy mosques, King Abdullah, of how to unify and strengthen the crisis-riven Muslim world. The real nitty-gritty off-limits to everyone was what the Saudis, the Iranians, and the Turks actually discussed behind these Mecca doors after the heartwarming voice museum went to bed. For show, the Mecca notables passed three resolutions. They suspended Syria, recognized Palestine as a sovereign state. Once again, note that Palestine was treated as just a side issue, and defended the cause of the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar. The military and Piadwa are not exactly quaking in their boots. The custodian show. What the custodian of the two holy mosques seems to have perpetrated is a savvy Washington-style PR coup. He was evidently advised to seat Ahmadinejad to his left and the Emir of Qatar to his right. The graphic message, this triumvirate to Sunni Wahhabi powers, one Khomeinistic Shiite is deciding the future of the Middle East. We Wahhabis are not bent on destroying those infidel Shiites. Not so fast. My colleague Kaveh Afrasiabi has argued Tehran may have fallen into a trap. They were expecting a real effort of mediation and political dialogue instead of the meeting's priority to suspend and eventually expel their ally Syria. See Saudis use summit to isolate Syria, around Asian Times online August 15th, 2012. Behind all the syrupy shenanigans, the fact is the House of Saud and Tehran didn't and couldn't possibly agree on anything. This was more like a let's keep talking, the Mecca version of the good old US-USSR red telephone. The custodian called for solidarity, tolerance, and moderation. Hard to see any of this as the House of Saud and Qatar weaponized runaway gangs and an array of beheading-happy Salafi jihadis in Syria. The OIC as a whole defended Syria's unity, sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity, exactly as the House of Saud and Qatar are doing all they can to undermine all of the above. Here's the OIC as an extension of the Saudi-led Gulf Cooperation Council. Other GCC members being Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, and United Arab Emirates. Quite a few countries from Southeast Asia to Africa are very uncomfortable with the whole thing, but in the end deferred to the custodian. The custodian also wants to set up a center for dialogue in Riyadh. The verdict is open whether the center will examine who's really responsible for what is now practically all-out war between Sunnis and Shiites all across the Ummah. Imagine a center like this coming to the conclusion that the protests in Bahrain were legitimate as the protests in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, and as legitimate as what happened last year in Cairo's Tahrir Square. Everyone remembers the House of Saud's sheer horror as its ally Hosni Mubarak being defied by scores of young urbanites. The custodian also said, the Islamic nation is living in a state of sedition and disunity that led to bloodshed of its people in this holy month in many parts of our Islamic world. On sedition, fitna in Arabic, it's unthinkable the custodian and his pampered House of Saud princes are not familiar with the Yinan plan. One and countless others whose divide and rule basis is exactly to incite a never-ending Sunni-Shiite war. with a cast of subdivisions including Muslims against Christians, Arabs against Persians, Turks against Persians, Arabs against Turks, and why not Kurds against Turks? That's exactly what is happening as the major intended or unintended blowback of Syria's proxy war. Why not have it both ways? So the custodian seems to have sold the notion that Iran and the GCC are talking, even if practically at each other's throats. But the House of Saud agenda remains extremely tricky. It may not dream of a smashed Iran, but certainly a very weakened Iran, either by years of Western sanctions or by a potential Israeli attack. It's no secret the GCC badly wants Israel to attack Iran. It then could reap the benefits of inwardly dividing over a weakened regional Shiite power while publicly condemning Israel's unilateral aggression. This farce, anyway, is far from over. Up next, Tehran has invited the custodian for the non-aligned movement, NAM, summit later this month. Let's see whether the House of Saud, the GCC, and Iran are really interested in ending fitna way beyond a photo op. There's still no evidence the leaders of 1.5 billion Muslims will ever get their act together. Not even Allah himself would make them see light. Okay, so this is Pepe Escobar, is the author of Globalistan, How the Globalized World is Dissolving into Liquid War. And it's very clever, isn't it? So, members, now, I just want to look at this summit, NAM, that was referred to. So I went and checked it out. The 16th summit of the non-aligned movement, it's going to open in Tehran on August 30th and close on Friday, August 31st. And there will be in this meeting, a senior officials meeting for the Islamic Republic of Iran will broadcast it. And it will be the political committee and an economic and social committee will be meeting. And there's more. So this is an upcoming, I guess they're going to attempt some type of unity. I went to the website. It's not exactly clear. It's probably kind of confidential what the agenda is, because we really don't know what we're doing, do we? Do we? Or do we? Do we? Who's running the show here? All right. I want to go to the scripture in Zechariah to conclude this set out. So from Zechariah 12, 1, the message of the word of Yahweh against Israel, Yahweh stretching out the heavens and laying the foundation of the earth and forming the spirit of man within him declares, see, I am making Yerushalayim a cup of reeling to all the peoples all around. That would qualify for Al-Quds Day. And also against Yehuda, it is in the siege against Yerushalayim. And in that day it shall be that I make Yerushalayim a very heavy stone for all peoples. All lifting it are severely injured, and all the nations of the earth shall be gathered around it. In that day, and this is that. I bless you. Keep looking up.